Okay, we'll continue with our program. Next paper is by Professor Tim Vivian on the origins of monasticism, specifically Egypt. Professor Tim Vivian actually has a page on Wikipedia, which I don't think he did, but...
I didn't put it there.
You're famous.
My dean put it there.
He's an American scholar of early Christianity, especially Egyptian monasticism, and professor of religious studies at California State University, Bakersfield. He has several scholarly publications in the field. And as he sent me in March, Cistercian Publication will publish volume one of two volumes of Professor Vivian's Sayings and Stories of the Desert Fathers and Mothers, an English translation with extensive notes. And in April, the University of America, that's AUC Press.
Yes.
Will publish The Life of Bishoy, edited by himself and Magid Mikhail. Then Lisa Agaibi and Tim are working with others on The Life of Paul of Thebes. Very important books. So without further ado, Professor Vivian.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Glad you're still awake. I'm going to read this off this old stuff we used to call paper. So here we go. This paper is a much shorter version of my article, The Origins of Monasticism, in the forthcoming T.N.T. Clark Companion to the Early Church, which will be published next year. What is the cosmogenesis of early Christian monasticism? Was there a Big Bang? Or was its cosmology a steady state, a slow development from earlier Judeo-Christian asceticism? In my article, I address asceticism in the New Testament, the first Christian writings, and I look at Syria, Palestine, and Asia Minor. But here, wary of the wrath of Hanni, I will address only monasticism in Egypt. For a long time, centuries even, Anthony grabbed the page one headlines for early Egyptian monasticism with a sidebar on Pachomius. And monastics who did not fit into the Antonian or Pachomian paradigm found themselves on page 15, scrunched between ads for condominiums and divorce lawyers. But sources in Egypt, especially the papyri, show that women and men in the 3rd to 5th centuries lived ascetic lives. The names of a few of these ascetics survive in the papyri. Okay, these words are alphabetized. So, for example, apotaktikos is the third one down for a male, and apotaktiki for a woman. These are apotaktites or renunciants. James Goering provides a succinct summary. From the papyri, one learns that apotaktikos was a church rank, that the apotaktikos could own land, that he might retain family ties, that the title later came to include women, and that it served to indicate an ascetic's more active position within the civil community, in distinction from the less active role of the anachoretes, the anchorite. Such an ascetic withdrew from certain social patterns of human existence. As Goering emphasizes early on, withdrawal to the desert, as Anthony did, was not central. The first extant use of monk in a technical sense applies not to an Anthony, who, the life of Anthony says, ultimately withdrew from society around 285, then around 313 withdrew to the interior desert. In fact, the life itself acknowledges that when Anthony began his ascetic life, quote, no monk at all knew the remote desert. Each one who wished to watch over himself spiritually we practice ascetic discipline, asceticism, by himself, not far from his own village. Anthony, indeed, apprentices himself to an old man or elder, Geron, who from, quote, his youth had practiced the solitary life of an ascetic. One such ascetic was Isaac of Charanis. In a petition for redress dated June 6, 324, a man claims that two men assaulted him and beat him, and, quote, would have finished me off completely, unquote, if the deacon Antoninus and the monk Isaac had not chanced to pass by and helped him. This is the first extant use of morcos. This in and of itself is important, but the occurrence turns out to be very important because Isaac is not the monk we probably assume. The petition takes it for granted that he can be identified by the public authorities. He is no remote hermit. On the other hand, his association with the deacon suggests that he is in some way church-related and not a monk from a Cenobitic monastery. As Goering points out, quote, Isaac represents a type of ascetic termed elsewhere an apotaktikos, unquote. The life of Anthony 14 vividly tells us, most likely accurately, that before the holy man left for the far desert, he attracted numbers of people who, quote, yearned for his way of life and wished seriously to follow his ascetic practice, unquote. The life adds that Anthony performed healings and offered counsel to the villagers. Goering's insight about Anthony may well apply also to Isaac. Quote, that persons from his village followed Anthony to his desert retreats and sought his presence might be interpreted to mean not that they wished to emulate him, but that they felt cheated by his departure. In seeking solitude in the desert away from the village, he was taking with him the power of God made available to the village through his presence. As I point out to my students, power occurs in the New Testament about 200 times. The ascetic had a function in the village, and Anthony's innovative departure called this function into question. Part two, virgins of God, early female ascetics, monastics. In fact, Susanna Elm has a wonderful book entitled Virgins of God, if you want to pursue that subject. Around 420, the monastic historian Palladius says that he, quote, must also commemorate some courageous women whom God granted equality and prizes with men so as not to allege that they are less vigorous in the quest for virtue. Around the year 400, also, Historia Monachorum in Aegypto tells us that Oxyrhynchus in Middle Egypt, quote, is so full of monasteries that the very walls resound with the voices of monks. And that, quote, there are said to be 5,000 monks within the walls and as many again outside. The bishop had under his jurisdiction 10,000 monks, monachos, and 20,000 virgins, parthenus. And I just noted yesterday his math doesn't quite add up, so I don't know how that works. Anyway, the figures here are most likely hyperbole, but they nevertheless offer some important evidence. First, as with the apotaktiki, male renunciants like Isaac living within the city, there were also in Oxyrhynchus, apotaktike, female ascetics. Second, if it is not an anachronistic statement, and by 400 it probably isn't, the monks, male and female, were under the jurisdiction of the local bishop. Third, there are twice as many female monks as male. What about documentary evidence? Here we are fortunate. In two letters, probably from the early 4th century, Didyme, with the sisters, writes to an Adelphi, a fellow sister monastic, about some business matters. In another letter, Didyme, with the sisters, writes, quote, to my beloved sister, Agapiti Adelphi. David Brackey notes that, quote, there were virgins in several of the cities and towns of Egypt in the 4th century. I think it's likely that there were more than in several towns and villages. I'd say many. Alana Emmett states, quote, there's no doubt that Didyme is a Christian and is writing on behalf of the sisters, an association of some kind on behalf of which she acts and writes. It's likely that one of her correspondents lived in Oxyrhynchus, which had, as we have seen, perhaps thousands of monks by 400. As Emmett concludes, Didyme and the sisters have not withdrawn from the world, but are aware of and catering for worldly and practical items. Didyme is running a warehouse. If this is in fact the case, are Didyme and the sisters female apotactites? And if Didyme is riding around 300, is her community like the well-known and faithful virgins whom Athanasius says Anthony gave his sister to? As Susanna L. bluntly states, women were in the desert, not only as apparitions in the minds of tormented fathers, but as real human beings. As with the term apotaktiki and apotaktike, the term monachi, female monk, can give us insights. An ostracon dating from the 4th to early 5th centuries uses the term monachi, as does a papyrus fragment from Oxyrhynchus on January 25th, 392. Anis, the apotaktite, lives on property she's inherited. A 4th century papyrus addresses Aurelia Theodora and Aurelia Tauris, apotactic monks, along with their father. Parthenos, virgin, is the most frequent designation of ascetic women in Christian literature. A Parthenos is not ordained but dedicates herself to a vow. The term ever virgin, i.e. Parthenos, occurs frequently. A 4th century papyrus is addressed to Nona and her ever-virgin daughter. A papyrus dated before 371 speaks of Didyme, different or same, ever-virgin, whose status, quote, is recognized administratively and socially. A particularly interesting papyrus from Lycopolis around 350 shows Bishop Pusianos in the forecourt of the church, adjudicating a dispute, I love that, between Thaises, ever virgin, and some of her heirs. The text reflect an early form of asceticism located in ordinary village and family life. Susanna Elm agrees, quote, as in Asia Minor, women in Egypt pursued their ascetic life within the confines of their own home and their own family, or else in community with others, whether men or women. Part 3, Anchorites, Semi-Anchorites, and Cenobites. One of the key transformative monks was Anthony the Great. A long-standing epithet for Antony is, quote, the father of monasticism, unquote. Antony could well be the father of eremitism, that is, desert asceticism, from Greek eremos, wilderness desert. That is the same word as John the Baptist John the Baptist and Jesus. But as we have seen with the Apatactites, there were village ascetics, including women before him. Some of the earliest sources tell us also about a schismatic Milesian monastic community at Hathor, a village near the Nile Delta. Another papyrus shows that virgins of God, a technical term, were there. This text provides evidence for groups, perhaps organized communities, of consecrated Milesian women. Goering summarizes that we may, quote, have here a Milesian organization which parallels closely the Pacomian kinonia, or community of monasteries, and thus challenges the usual assumption of such a system as a Pacomian innovation. The first monastic biography, Hagiography, in the doublet is very important. Athanasius's Life of Antony raises a serious question or questions. Although it is very difficult to know how much and what portions of Athanasius's Life of Antony are historical, two very important statements by the Bishop of Alexandria early on deserve our attention and seem very plausible. As we saw earlier, when Antony embraces a life of asceticism, he learns from an old man or elder in the neighboring village and entrusts his sister, quote, to well-known and faithful virgins, giving her to them to be raised in virginity, unquote. As Goering has emphasized, Antony's early significance is not that he founded the ascetic life, but that he, quote, withdrew from village life into remoter and remoter places, the desert. When Antony decided to become an ascetic, there were already men and women living as Christian ascetics in towns and villages, the Apatactites. According to tradition, around 340, Antony one time paid a visit to Abba Amund at the monastic settlement of Nitria, Wadi Nitra. Later that day, they walk out into the desert, plant a cross, and found a monastic settlement, depending on the sources, 5 to 12 miles from Nitria. Perhaps eventually 600 anchorites lived in this area with its own church. Its name was Kelia, Cells. The settlements of Nitria, Kelia, and Skitas became the most important in Lower Egypt, the Wadi al-Natrum. It is best to describe the monks of the Wadi Natrun at this time as semi-anchorites. At least early on, the monks lived alone or with another monk, who was often a disciple. The Apothemata shows that. In scattered cells of 2 to 3 rooms where they would pray and do handiwork. The monks would come to the main area of the settlement where the church was on Saturday and Sunday, for the synaxis, communal prayer, common meal, and the Eucharist on Sunday. Some of the great figures of early Egyptian monasticism were at the Wadi Natrun: Arsenius, Evagrius, John the Little, Macarius the Great, Moses, Toymaine, and many others. Evagrius was the first great monastic theologian and one of the great patristic writers on spirituality. His statement on prayer may be the most quoted aphorism from early monasticism. If you are a theologian, you truly pray. If you truly pray, you are a theologian. A footnote, Evagrius does come into the West, and we even see this as early as the Apothemata, but in Palladius and folks, his name disappears because he was suspect and connected with Origen and all that stuff. Evagrius shows that a collection of apophthegmata or sayings existed before 400, and monks in Palestine most likely edited them in the 5th to 6th centuries. Translations and versions exist among many in Greek, Coptic, Syriac, Latin, Ethiopic, Armenian, and Arabic. Thus, the sayings and stories saw very wide diffusion in the Roman world and far beyond. Part 4, Pachomius. The four early monasteries of the Wadi Natrun, Macarius, Bishoy, Cyrene, and John the Little, eventually evolved, except John's monastery, from semi-anchoritic communities into the cenobitic monasteries today. The Pachomian Kinonia community used apotaktikos for its members, showing that the term could mean what we call Cenobite. As with Anthony as the father of monasticism, we now know that it is simplistic to restrict monasticism to the desert regions. Goering prefers that we call the communities founded by Pachomius, quote, urban asceticism, unquote. Pachomius founded his first two communities, seven more were added during his lifetime, and eventually there were two monasteries for women, in a fertile valley in or near villages whose names they bore. At the time of his death in 346, the communities for men numbered some 5,000 monks. Properly understood, Armand Veilleux adds, Pachomian monasticism is not a product of the desert, but a form of village asceticism. Pachomius founded his first two communities at Tabanese and Pabau, a short distance away. Ascetic withdrawal here and probably at the later communities was within the village, eventually behind a gated wall. It is likely that the subsequent communities followed the same pattern. Goering makes the following important assessment about the Kinonia. As papyrus evidence of the urban apotactites illustrates their legal and social connection with the wiser community, so too the Pachomian evidence reveals the Pachomian's legal and social integration within Roman Egypt. Again, like the apotactites, Pachomian communities own land, paid taxes. The eventual creation of a steward at each monastery and a great steward for the Kinonia as a whole shows these communities' social and commercial involvement. Armand Veilleux argues that Pachomius did not think, quote, of founding a new form of monasticism, but sought to establish a cooperative brotherhood, hence the name Kinonia. Veilleux sees the ideal of mutual service, quote, lying at the root of the nascent Pachomian Kinonia or community, and constituting, quote, the essence of his spirituality, unquote. Pachomius and his communities have left us with numerous literary works, and thanks to Veilleux, Lives of Pachomius in Coptic, Greek, and Arabic, Rules that constantly evolved with the evolution of the Kinonia, Catechesis, instructions on scripture that the heads of houses taught with twice a week, and letters that are either Pachomius's or have their provenance in a Pachomian milieu. According to Veilleux, the living community that he left behind him taught many generations of male and female monastics much more than all the books of spirituality he could have written. His disciples left a very detailed description of his spiritual journey and of his activity as a founder, unquote. I thought I'd better add this last guy given the name of the conference we're at. Part 5, Shenouda. Shenouda the Great, or the Archimandrite, although unknown in the West until the late 17th century, was the greatest native writer of Coptic in history. The Pachomian model directly inspired Shenouda, and he viewed Pachomius as a forefather. By 372, he became a monk at the White Monastery in Atropatene in Upper Egypt, led by his uncle. He became the leader of the monastery around 396 and eventually consolidated and directed a federation of three monasteries, two for men and one for women, and became the most important Christian leader in the region. At least 1,000 men and women joined the federation, which he led as a desert hermit until close to his death. Although his influence eventually extended into Lower Egypt, Shenouda has been a controversial figure, partly because of his polemics, and partly because he used violence at least several times against non-Christian opponents. Shenouda saw himself as a voice crying out in the wilderness. He wanted to create an ascetic culture separate from the world, within which the monk could seek his salvation, and sought to bring his message of repentance, moral purity, and fidelity to Christ and his church to the larger Christian community in the region of Panopolis. Shenouda also became a very important civic leader, something new in monasticism. And his goals and methods led to conflict, especially with lay elites in Panopolis and with non-Christians. He led an attack on a temple, traveled to other cities to defend Christians who had attacked temples, and led raids on the homes of wealthy non-Christians. But Shenouda was not merely local. He also saw himself as an advocate for Alexandrian theology and patriarchal rule, even accompanying Archbishop Cyril to the Council of Ephesus in 431. Shenouda, however, was not just about preaching in politics. What we now call social justice and social service inspired part of his vision. He attacked a former governor's alleged paganism, but he also attacked his and other wealthy men's oppressive actions against the poor. After barbarian invasions in the 440s, thousands of people, Shenouda says 20,000, fled to the White Monastery, which provided them with shelter, food, and medical care for 3 months. Conclusion. Thus, as we have seen, early monasticism in Egypt evolved greatly from the late 3rd century to the 5th. The Apotactites, Semi-Anchorites, Anchorites, and Cenobites, and figures male and female, created what evolved into a worldwide phenomenon in many varieties. Monasticism is no longer a phenomenon, but perhaps in our secularized, materialistic, and monetized world, it is. It has, though, remained spiritually important for many, many people, monastic and non-monastic. And we can give thanks for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I guess there is a big comment here from Peter. Okay, I believe it was Brackey who contend that Saint Athanasius wrote the life of Antony in large part to effectively legitimize the oversight of bishops with regards to monastics as a whole. Is it true insofar as this being the first patriarchal move to do as such? Well, if monastics were under the local bishops prior to the penning of this hagiographical work, as may have been suggested in this presentation, if I heard it correctly, if this was the reality prior to the production of that work, does that lessen the commonly presented divide between the church episcopal hierarchy and the monastic thread of existence in its formative inception?
Yeah, Brackey's book if anyone's interested, is Athanasius and the Politics of Asceticism. It's very clear the earliest ascetics were not connected with the local bishop, with a bishop. There's a famous monastic saying, I can't remember who said it, beware women and bishops. Well, that tells you there was conflict. I'm generalizing, but my thinking is that as bishops grew more in power in many, many, many ways, that they naturally sought to get more control over the monks. I think a big precipitant of this was the Originist controversy, with the Tall Brothers and all of that. Some of you may know that some of the monasteries were very Originist, and when Originists fell into ill repute, you had great conflict over that. And so I think in general, religions tend to centralize. I think by the time we get to someone like Shenouda, the bishops do have control, maybe not control, but a large say over the monasteries, yeah.
Daniel's saying, is there an accessible history of monasticism, early asceticism, before St. Anthony?
Well, you notice I mentioned Jim Gering's name a lot. His book, whose title I'm forgetting, of course, right now, in my books at school, it collects his articles, and several of them touch on pre-Antonian monasticism. The famous article on the Apotactites is, Ascetic Society in the Desert. Thank you. Peter still has a memory, which I don't. E.A. Judge wrote a groundbreaking article on that monk Isaac eons ago, but Goering does a good, basically retells the article. People like Susanna Elm and some of the other women who have written on monasticism have explored the role of women in the early church, like as in Paul's letters, the widows and virgins. Our evidence is so spotty, but I think it's very reasonable that monasticism evolved out of the widows and virgins. I don't see that as being unreasonable that men said, oh, that's really cool, let's do that. So, when you have so many hundreds or thousands of women and we have virtually nothing by them, there are only four women in the Apophthegmata. We have to do a lot of guessing and stretching.
They took the vow of silence. Hard to believe, but who knows?
Okay.
There's a question from Janet. Do you see the question from Janet Temby?
Janet. Hi, Janet.
Any thoughts about the origin of the monastic rule? Agreeing to live under a rule seemed like a very significant development that takes place in Egypt and influences all monasticism in the West.
Wow. St. Basil is mid-4th century, correct? So you have Basil's rules, and you have Pacomian rules. So seems to me it's like a mid-4th century phenomenon, whether they're Egyptian influence Basil? Certainly possible. I just don't know on that one.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hopefully we'll have some time for questions at the end for the whole panel. But okay. Now we're going to turn over to Mark. Let me stop the recording.